Welcome to the Northeast Christian Podcast. We're so excited that you've decided to check out our weekly messages. We hope that you're challenged and inspired by what you're hearing today. We'd love to have you join us this weekend at one of our campuses or online at northeast.live. For more information on Northeast, visit us at necchurch.org. If you love the Northeast Podcast, subscribe to our channel and leave us a comment or a rating in the Apple Podcast Store. This weekend's message is from Tyler McKenzie. He's the lead pastor here at Northeast.
Last sermon of the series today. This weekend, it's my turn to talk about my sin. So the central sin of my life is not salacious, but it is pervasive. And if you know me, then what I say next is not going to surprise you at all. I, Tyler, have always struggled with achievement addiction. For some reason, I just got to be the best. And by the best, I mean I got to be better than you. And better than him, and better than her, and better than all my peers, better than all y'all. And for the record, it's nothing against you. I like you. I hope you're great. I just need to be better than you in order to feel satisfied, happy in my heart. Now, it sounds like I'm being playful right now, but really I'm not. I'm pretty sure that I was born with this unhealthy ambition. I remember in the first grade, Miss Coe's class, she had this reading competition. On the wall, there were these little fish tanks that she would put your name in, depending on how many books you read. There was a 50-plus tank, 100-plus tank, 200-plus tank. It was this scoreboard declaring to the classroom who the best reader was. And I had to be the best. And I was the best. Well, except for this one kid in my class named David White. I don't know what was wrong with David, but apparently all he did was read. While other kids would like go home and, I don't know, eat snacks, play outside, watch a show, sleep, David would just read. He was always a little bit ahead of me. I'd come back having read two books, he would have read three. I'd read four books, he would have read five. The whole entire school year, his name was just a little further out. So I'll go ahead and tell you, 7-year-old Tyler just couldn't stand that, at least not for long. My dad was a preacher. And he always taught me, Tyler, never cheat, unless you have to. And I had to, so I did what I had to do. I went home, I recorded all the books on my shelf, and then I turned them into my teacher, and I took a commanding lead. I was the best. But only for a moment, because one day my mom walked into my room, she pulled the stack of books off the shelf that I had recently read, and she started quizzing me on them. Tyler, what's this book about? Who's the main character? Tell me one thing that happened in this book, Tyler. I couldn't. I'd been caught. And I had to go confess my sin to my teacher, and then I had to stand in front of my entire class and apologize to David White. It was easily the worst day of my life. And why? Because I had to be the best. And that day, the whole world found out that I wasn't. Now, if you're like me and you're a sports nut, when COVID canceled like all the games, you turned on this documentary series, The Last Dance. It's a documentary on the basketball career of Michael Jordan, the second greatest player of all time. And if you're like me, you were inspired by Jordan's competitive drive to be the greatest. But if I'm being honest with you, that wasn't what surprised me. Like, I watched Jordan play. I know how driven he was. The fact that he would do literally anything to win, literally anything to get the edge, that wasn't revelatory to me. No, the revelatory part of the docuseries was the cost of his pursuit of greatness. Did you see it? Like, how much anxiety, angst, loneliness, and emotion this pursuit for greatness actually burdened him with. It was crushing. I mean, think about this for a second, y'all. He retired in the middle of his prime after winning 3 titles in a row. Who does that? Only someone who realizes that the burden of being the best actually outweighs the reward. And then he came back a couple years later because he couldn't live without it. And what a dysfunctional relationship to have with your life calling. One second you can't live with it, one second you can't live without it. Now, not only that, but his drive actually ruined his relationship with a lot of his teammates. His teammates didn't like him. You find that out in the docuseries. They liked winning, but not him. And it was because of his drive for being great. Mary Bell, a counselor who works with high-level executives, once said this. She said, achievement is the alcohol of our time. These days, the best people don't abuse alcohol. They abuse their lives. She then goes on to use the addiction cycle to describe how achievement just tears us down. So what is the addiction cycle? Well, the addiction cycle is this downward spiral that addicts experience in which they need more and more of their drug in order to get less and less of the original high over time. And that's where achievement addicts end up. We get so addicted that all our thoughts, our time, our energy are channeled towards getting the drug, achieving more, rising another rung on the ladder. And before you know it, it's burnt all of our relationships down, tied all of our energy up, and we're strung out in need of an overdose of achievement to just feel normal again. In the movie Chariots of Fire, one of the main characters, Harold Abrahams, was an Olympic sprinter that won the gold in the 1924 100 meter. And he eloquently articulates the mindset of an achievement addict when they hit rock bottom. When he was asked, why do you run? He said it wasn't because he loves it. Rather, he says, I'm more of an addict. Contentment. I'm 24 and I've never known it. I'm forever in pursuit and I don't even know what it is I'm chasing. I'll raise my eyes, look down that corridor 4 feet wide with 10 lonely seconds to justify my whole existence. But will I? But will I? I've told some of y'all this before. I remember when I was in seminary, before I ever had a full-time job in ministry, one of my professors asked me, Tyler, what do you want to accomplish in your life in ministry? And this is what I said to him. I want to be the best. I want to be the best preacher of my generation. And I wanted it for all the wrong reasons. Personal disclosure here for you. Did you know that that's why I decided to be a no-notes preacher? So if you know me right now, this is really, really weird. Pulpit, paper, not typical for me, but purposeful today. See, I never preach with notes. Lots of people will say, I don't know how you do that. What a gift. Well, it's a little bit of a gift. I have a good memory. But I think it's more of an acquired skill over time. Takes hard work to build. It's a muscle, if you will. And when I first started preaching, I was determined to be a no-notes preacher. And you know why? Because I thought to myself, that's what will set me apart. That's the only way for me to be the very best. Now today, I couldn't imagine preaching any other way because it's the only thing I've known, but I still remember the shallow, selfish reasons why I chose it. And every week, when I walk on stage without a note, it may appear to be a strength to you, but if you could see past the facade of charisma and giftedness that I'm trying to project, you'd see the truth. One of my greatest strengths is really a scarlet letter of my own personal sin. And that's why today I've decided to preach this sermon with notes. This is me. I'm an achievement addict. And I know it's some of you too. And I want you to know that this is going to disillusion and destroy us over time if we don't reorder our loves. It will demand more and more. It will give less and less until it owns us and has disintegrated our ability to feel and be. I promise. And if you haven't woken up to this yet, I want to unveil to you today your future as an achievement addict. What it looks like to be strung out and addicted by showing you 6 horrifying realities of achievement worship that you'll realize sooner or later. Here's the first one. First, and eventually you're going to have to face this reality, guys. First, I'm never going to be the best. This is what every achievement addict realizes. You want to know why I know that? Because there's only one best. So no matter how much you achieve, you'll always wake up the next morning realizing that there's someone who's a little bit better than you. And let's just say that you just so happen to be the one, though. You just so happen to be the very, very best. You won't remain the best forever, because someday you'll retire, and then someday you'll die, and then someday after that, someone will break your record, steal your glory, knock your name off the top, and you won't be the best anymore. Look, the pursuit is vainglory, y'all. And the reality is that I'm never going to be the best. Second, eventually you'll realize that God didn't create me to live like this anyways. Now, let me diagram it for you. First, in our culture, the metrics for best usually boil down to a combination of the following four things. Acclaim, fame, fortune, and power. What are people saying about me? How many people admire me? How much money does this make me? And how much power do I have? And the goal ultimately is just to raise these bars over time. You start at a little above average, and then people are like, hey, you're crushing it, bro. And then all of a sudden you reach the verified account on social media stage. And trust me, that little check mark will validate your existence. And then up and up you go to the Hall of Fame and beyond. That's what a lot of us pursue. We're taught, we're discipled in our culture to pursue that. Now, here's the only problem though. God's metrics operate on an entirely different plane. See, this is not how God created you to live. So if you pursue these metrics, you will be perpetually frustrated at how shallow and fleeting the gratification is and how unshakable the emptiness and exhaustion is. Now, here's how God actually created you to live. No matter your vocation, he actually created you to be born again in Christ and then spend the rest of your life surrendering more and more of you to Jesus. It's called the sanctification process. And I want you to notice what isn't on the scoreboard. Acclaim, fame, fortune, or power. God could care less, y'all. In fact, here's what I can guarantee you. If you achieve on Jesus' scoreboard, you will not be as rich, you will not be as beloved, you will not be as admired, you will not be as preeminent. Instead, you will be poor in spirit, pure in heart, persecuted, patient, kind, gentle, faithful, self-controlled, and full of love. This is why when heaven falls, Jesus says that the last are going to be first and the first are going to be last. Because this world isn't set up right now to reward faithfulness. But God says one day eternity will reward it. So let me set the record straight right now. God didn't create you to be the best. And God doesn't want you to be the best. He just wants you to be faithful. I remember recognizing early on in my ministry that I had this unhealthy ambition inside of me. And it was festering in me. And so I wanted to know what the Bible said about ambition. What was the limits? What does healthy ambition look like in Christ? So I did a word study. The Greek word philotimeomai is the verbal idea to have as one's ambition. And it's actually only used three times in the New Testament, all by the Apostle Paul. And there are three different things that Paul actually says he has ambition for. I'll just read these verses to you and you can do all the application yourself. 2 Corinthians 5:9, Paul says, so whether we are at home or away, we make it our aim or we make it our ambition to please God. Romans 15:20, Paul says, thus I make it my ambition to what? To proclaim the good news. Not where Christ has already been named, so that I do not build on someone else's ambition. Or foundation. In 1 Thessalonians 4:10, Paul says, but we urge you, beloved, to do so more and more and to have as your ambition, to aspire to live quietly, to mind your own affairs, to work with your hands as we directed you so that you may behave properly towards outsiders and be dependent on no one. Third, you will find out. And this may be the most crushing revelation of them all. That you're not actually enjoying what you love anymore. That's what an achievement addiction will do to you. It actually steals the joy of your calling in life. Now, have I ever told you guys how much I love to preach? I love it. I love everything about it. I love the process of preparing, the praying, the studying, the preaching. Okay, if I could delegate, I'd have to do other things besides preach as a leader of this church. But I could delegate everything and just focus exclusively on preaching and teaching, the preparation, the prayer, and the study that goes into that. I would do that in a heartbeat because I love it that much. I never feel closer to God than I do when I'm preaching. There's this intimacy and joy that just rushes through me to know I'm doing exactly what God created me to do. But when I slide into achievement mode and my motivation becomes, you gotta be the best, it actually steals my joy. Every week when I walk off stage, I can't relish in the fact that God used me, but instead I'm so self-critical. I think of all the things I did wrong, all the things I should do better or have to get right the next time. I judge my success in a sermon based on butts in seats. Not faithfulness, not whether or not I prayed over it and heard from God, and yes, this is the sermon you're supposed to preach, but what the weekend attendance numbers say. I kid you not, when I first became lead pastor at Northeast, we used to send out our weekend attendance reports every Monday morning, and I would wake up on my day off and click refresh until we'd get the attendance report. And then I would judge my sermon on the previous day based on the attendance. So if we were like 4% down or something, I'd be like, what's happening? Or if we were 7% up, I'd be like, I'm God's gift to Louisville. And literally, it would just ebb and flow. Based not on faithfulness, but based on how many people came to listen. You know, sometimes good preaching's thinning the herd. But I didn't care about that. Or how about this? When I have to be the best, I can't even listen to other preachers. And I love listening to other preachers. My car does not move without sermons on. But when my heart is in an unhealthy place, all I do the whole time is compare myself to them. And if I'm better than them, I feel prideful. If I'm not, I feel envious. And it steals my joy. Teddy Roosevelt once said, comparison is the thief of joy. And that's where achievement addiction takes you. Joyless comparison. Fourth, if you're an achievement addict, and some of you need to say this out loud, so repeat after me, because this is tragic. If you are an achievement addict, then you are going to ruin your kids. Repeat after me. I'm going to ruin my kids. Because you are. Achievement culture is ruining our kids. You see, our kids adopt the beliefs that we have. And right now, we see it in our kids. They feel this tremendous amount of pressure to achieve as individuals as we live vicariously through them. Oh, you wanna play a sport? That's great, but you can't just play a sport, you have to play travel ball. And you can't just play travel ball, you have to play on that travel team. And you can't just play on that travel team, we have to sell our entire lives to it. We're not gonna go to church anymore on weekends. I thought Jesus was most important, he is, but we're not gonna go to church anymore on weekends. And we're gonna get you out of school sometimes on Friday, and we're gonna spend a lot of money so you can get a soccer scholarship someday that won't actually be more than the money that we spend on it, but don't do the math. Oh, and speaking of college, by the way, you've got to be in the top 10% of your class so you can go to that college. And by go to that college, I mean you're gonna have to spend like 6 years there and get 2 degrees and a mound of student debt. And why do you need to do that? Well, so you can compete for that job. And by that job, I mean the job that's gonna make you successful and get you all the fame, acclaim, power, and fortune that we've prayed for you since the day you were born. That's what achievement culture looks like. A New York Times article recently wrote that two of the greatest lies ruining the rising generation are the following. One, career success is fulfilling, and two, happiness is a product of individual achievement. And where do you think they got those ideas from? Last realization. Achievement addicts, here's the worst news of them all, last. There's no one coming to help. Look, when you're an achiever, you look great. You look successful. And that's because by the metrics of this world, you are. In fact, that's part of the achiever strategy. You learn to over-exaggerate how good things are going for you so that people will admire you even more. When you're an achiever, you look awesome. You're crushing it, man. And so no one's coming to help you. They think you're doing fine. Look, when you're addicted to like an unhealthy substance, people usually notice and they intervene. People check in on you. But when you're an achievement addict, people don't check in on you. They admire you. So no one's coming to help. All right, that's pretty dark. So a quick review here. Here's the truth of achievement worship. One, I'm never gonna be the best. Two, God didn't create me to live like this. Three, I'm not enjoying what I love anymore. Four, I'm going to ruin my kids. And five, there's no one coming to help. And that's what you got to look forward to. Now, here's what I know for a fact. There are hundreds upon hundreds of people listening right now who this is your life. You know this. In fact, for many of you, you're gonna flip this sermon off here in a second and then you'll get on your email, even though it's Sunday, so you can knock a few things off your to-do list. For some of you, you're listening to this right now as you squeeze in 30 minutes at the gym in your 12-hour-a-day work schedule. Or for others of you, as soon as it's over, you're gonna pull out your phone, jump on social media, and start to count all the likes and comments and shares, hoping that someone sees you and validates your existence. This is the tragedy. This is the tragedy of living in an individualistic culture. See, individualistic cultures teach us that your worth is determined comparatively through individual achievements that engender horizontal approval. There's your cultural diagnosis for today. And that is a tragedy, y'all. That's a tragedy. Because you see, here's what the enemy doesn't want you to know. Making achievement your highest love in life is a sin. It's idolatry. And the deceitful thing about living in sin isn't pure misery. In fact, living in sin isn't misery at all at first. It feels kind of good. It lures you in. It can feel life-giving for a time. This is a picture of Luis Ciccone, or otherwise known as Madonna. In her unprecedented music career, Madonna sold more than 300 million records worldwide. She's recognized as the Guinness World Record holder for best-selling female recording artist ever. Her achievements are too long to list, but here's what she says about her success. Sums it up well. She says, "I have an iron will, and all of my will has always been to conquer some horrible feeling of inadequacy. I push past one spell of it and discover myself as a special human being. And then I get to another stage and think I'm mediocre and uninteresting. Again and again, I go through this vicious cycle. My drive in life is from this horrible fear of being mediocre. And that's always pushing me. Because even though I've become somebody, I still got to prove that I'm somebody. My struggles never ended. And it probably never will." You know, it's always interesting to me. When you read the story of the Garden of Eden, when Adam and Eve sin, shame immediately runs them through. And they cover up with fig leaves. Such an odd part of the story. They cover up with fig leaves and hide from God because they realize they're naked. Now, the whole thing feels kind of elementary, right? Fig leaves? Really? Until you realize that that's exactly what we're doing. Ashamed of our own frailty, embarrassed of our own inability to achieve our way into happiness, we try and cover it up. I mean, what's your LinkedIn account? Your Twitter bio? Your resume? It's modern day fig leaves, man. Why do you have to tell people that you're a lawyer, you're a doctor, you're a partner? It's fig leaves. Why do you need to project this insta-perfect version of your life? It's modern day fig leaves. You're just covering up the shame. I mean, why do you have to drive that car, wear that brand, live in that neighborhood? Wealth signal, virtue signal. It's fig leaves, a vain attempt to convince ourselves and others that the shame we feel is just an illusion. And what's bad about this shame management is that it damages the intimacy of our relationships with others. But what's worse is that it separates us from God, the only one who truly loves you no matter what you achieve. And most of us live lives knowing we belong in the garden. So we try and recreate paradise here, only to find that we can't. C.S. Lewis said it like this once. He wrote, "Our lifelong nostalgia, our longing to be reunited with something in the universe from which we now feel cut off, to be on the inside of some door which we have always seen from the outside, is no mere neurotic fancy, but the truest index of our real situation." And that, my friends, is my life in a nutshell. That, my friends, is why I need Jesus. And that, my friends, is why you need him too. And it's why I think you should become a Christian today, if you never have before. Your heart aches, it longs. But it's not for another success. It's not for another record-breaking quarter. It's not for another promotion. It's not for another lifestyle bump. You may have convinced yourself that that's what you need, but I'm here to tell you that it ain't. What your heart truly aches for is Jesus. Now, our culture says you earn salvation through what you achieve. Religion says you earn salvation through what you achieve. But then Jesus walks on stage and he blows it all up and he says they both got it wrong. Salvation isn't achieved, it's received. It's only received. And it can only be received, as we've seen throughout this series, through humble surrender. The very antithesis of achievement. Which is why, if you are like me, you will spend the rest of your life resisting this with all the self-preserving, self-glorifying might that you have. But I'm begging you today not to resist it, but instead to humble yourself and rest in Jesus. See, we all worship something, enslave ourselves to something. For me, it's been the God of achievement. But I'm here to tell you that when you enslave yourself instead to Jesus, he is the only God that immediately turns and sets all the slaves free. He freed me to find life in my calling, even though it doesn't pay in fame, acclaim, fortune, or power. He freed me to cheer other people on and empower their successes rather than seeing them as competition. He freed me to rest when I need it because I know the sum of me is not based on what I achieve. He freed me to confess my wrongs and drop the mask because my righteousness does not depend on my rightness. He freed me to play the game of life courageously, taking huge risks, knowing that I'm secure in his grace and sovereignty. He freed me from the lies of anxiety and depression that whisper, "You're blowing it. You're letting them down. You're worthless. You're not that good." And instead, I can sing, "I'm a child of God." He freed me from the pride of thinking that the church will only prevail if Tyler is great. He freed me to experience joy no matter my successes or failures, contentment when I have a lot or I have a little, and peace no matter the circumstances of my life because I am deeply accepted by the Father, unconditionally loved by Jesus, and possessed by the Spirit of holiness. I'm free. But I'm free because I recognize just how little I can achieve on my own. Are you free? Here's how to be free today. Luke chapter 18, Jesus says, "But the tax collector stood at a distance and dared not even lift his eyes to heaven as he prayed. Instead, he beat his chest in sorrow, saying, 'Oh God, have mercy on me, for I'm a sinner.' And I tell you," Jesus said, "I tell you, this sinner, not the Pharisee, but the sinner, returned home justified before God, free. For those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted." This is where life is found. This is where eternity begins. This is how to live the exalted life, humility. And it can all start today with this humble declaration: "God, have mercy on me, for I'm a sinner." So look, 5 weeks later, Melinda has prayed this prayer before you. Chris Morgan prayed it. Joey Keck, John Lee, Tamara Brown prayed it last week. I pray it before you today. God, have mercy on me, for I'm a sinner. We went first. But now it's your turn.